Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, both of today's guests have atypical careers. They venture where most of us don't. They see and experience life as most of us won't. And they face challenges and danger on an almost daily basis that most of us would, quite frankly, run away from. My second guest today is number one New York Times bestselling author of War and the Perfect Storm. He's Sebastian Junger. And his new book is a Publishers Weekly most anticipated book of 2016. It's also an Entertainment Weekly top 25 books in 2016. And I have to tell you, certainly it's a small book. For those watching on camera, you can see it's a small book, but it really did make me think. It is called Tribe on Homecoming and Belonging. And we'll be talking with Sebastian in the second half of today's show. Coming up first, we'll be talking with Explorer correspondent Justin Hall. He's a journalist and filmmaker and describes himself as a jack of all trades. Very interesting background. And he's been working as an Explorer correspondent and on the new National Geographic Channel TV series, which is really exciting. And it's actually going to air this Sunday. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that. But we're going to take a very quick break, first of all. And then I'll bring you my conversation with Justin Hall. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Please stay with us.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Make us part of your daily routine. Alternative Talk, 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we are airing live. I did, however, talk with both of my guests last week. And so we're bringing our recorded conversations to you. You know, coming this Sunday, June 26th, on National Geographic Channel, you can watch my first guest today. He's Explorer correspondent Justin Hall, and he ventures into Virunga National Park in Africa. Let me tell you a little bit about Justin. Describes himself as a jack of all trade. He's spent many years in some of the most remote and dangerous places on Earth, cultivating contacts among Ukrainian mercenaries, Colombian hitmen, Middle Eastern sheiks, and the high-level government officials. And along the way, he developed a passion for wildlife, tribal people, and the environment while he was working on the series Tribal Journeys with Academy Award-nominated anthropologist and filmmaker Jean-Pierre Dutelot. I talked with Justin about his latest adventure as the explorer correspondent for National Geographic Channel's acclaimed series. And let me tell you a little bit about Virunga for those of you who are not familiar with it, and I'll just set this up for you. Virunga National Park is one of the most biologically diverse protected areas on the planet. It houses half of all plant and animal species in the sub-Saharan African. Africa can be found in Virunga. And it's also a geological wonder. Pot of gold, my guest called it, contains two of the world's most active volcanoes. And in addition to that, it's rife with militia. And so Explorer embeds with the militia, threatening Africa's oldest national park. And Justin Hall was the Explorer correspondent. And so let's hear from him now, Justin Hall. Well, Justin, first of all, I want to say this is a fascinating story. But before we get into the show that we're going to talk about, the Explorer Battle for Virunga, I want to just share a little bit about you with our listeners. Because I was watching you on video and I couldn't help but smile by your enthusiasm. You describe yourself as not the standard correspondent. You say you're a wide-eyed, enthusiastic guy who loves the world we live in. How did you get into this kind of work and why?
I traveled widely when I was a young man, and not with unlimited budgets, just by hook or by crook, sort of throwing myself out there. And in doing that, working from place to place, you naturally stumble upon the most... Well, you realize very quickly about the wider world and the beautiful mosaic of cultures and characters that are out there. And stepping away from your own hometown and your own city and your own country, you just become awash with these incredibly inspiring things. So that sort of drove me from the first moments that I stepped off the boat or onto the plane. Slowly but surely, I got more progressively into more remote places. And it was actually a meeting, not until I was 30 years old, in fact, having, as I said, played with the planet for so many years, enjoying myself and just all of this chaotic travel. I was turning 30, and that's a pretty crucial time in most people's lives. And on that very day, I was in Los Angeles at a dinner party, and I bumped into a character called Jean-Pierre Dutilleux, an incredible ethnographer, wearing a safari suit at a dinner.
Right.
They're talking about his adventures with the Kayapo Indians and working with Sting and traveling the world, meeting with tribes. And I latched onto him instantly and said, look, I'm not going to let you go until you can give me an opportunity to prove that I can help you out with what you do. I don't need money, nor do I have any, but just give me a chance. And he did, and that introduced me to the sort of indigenous tribal focus that I've been very passionate about for many years. And, of course, that took me on to other things, like the Explorer series.
Right. And so what did you do for him? How did you prove to him that, hey, I can be of help here?
Well, first off, I rewrote his... he'd made 15 films, a Belgian French speaking character, and he wanted to translate those. So I translated them for him, or not translated, but rewrote them in a vernacular, a word, a term of phrase that expressed perhaps deeper than he had anticipated, and sort of proved to him that I was deeply invested in this already and had the potential to do it. I also was planning to go to Brazil with him, but he decided to take a beautiful assistant instead of myself. I thought it was pretty unfair. It was the day before I was supposed to go, and I told all my friends, I'm going to the jungle, I'm going to meet the chief Kayapo Indian. And he let me down and took a beautiful lady.
Go figure.
I decided that was not enough, so I wasn't going to give up. I went back to England on my own. And I sat there convinced, with no experience, certainly not in producing, directing, or presenting. I was convinced that I could find a way. So I put together an idea and more or less put a pin in the map of, and found a remote tribe that were working on, working with pharmaceutical companies and for a cure to cancer and witch doctors and all of these things. And I put the pitch together and I pitched it with my heart, and an incredible character came and backed it. And that was it. I started. So my first trip was in 2000, and I used interactive sort of technologies to communicate directly to the field, from the field to the very initial stages of the World Wide Web.
Yeah, so interesting.
That was really it.
Yeah, interesting. And you are, of course, known as the adventurer who loves technology. We don't always think the two go together, but these days they very much do. I'm wondering, what are two pieces of technology you never will travel without?
Well, I think they're changing every day, actually. I mean, certainly you can capture and convey your world in wonderful ways with the likes of, the new 360 VR systems that are coming out. Your mobile phone is an incredibly powerful tool. I mean, in fact, statistics on that are amazing. The Samsung or the Apple, the computer power of those phones is about 160 million times the power of the computer that steered the first craft towards the moon.
Wow.
So if we can land, if clever science and brave people can land on the moon with that type of computer, imagine what we can do with our phone. So I'm a big advocate of telling stories using the tools you have. They needn't be, near NASA type technology that costs you £1 million. So I'm looking to always, communicate those things and capture them. And how can we tell stories?
Absolutely, absolutely. So let's talk about this story that's coming up, the Battle for Virunga. It is Africa's largest and oldest national park, about 3,000 square miles, is that right?
Indeed, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, no less.
And so that means that it has the protection status, the same kind of status as Yellowstone or the Great Barrier Reef, you say, or it should mean it, but it actually doesn't. And this whole area you described as a pot of gold, it's rich in natural resources, and that's causing all the trouble. So talk to us a little bit about what's going on there, Justin.
Well, as you rightly say, I mean, it's a beautiful area that has such a complex history, and it's one of the richest, from a mineral perspective, places on the planet. Diamonds, gold, tin, zinc, hardwoods, previously ivory, rubber. Sort of the last 125 years of its history has been fairly traumatic because of the way that the wider world has viewed those resources. Currently, the forces that impact Virunga are more basic. I mean, of course, there are threats in the form of oil companies potentially taking advantage of the landscape, but I think those have gone away slightly since public opinion raised in the last couple of years. But we focused within this story on two sides, actually. We thought it was really important, explorer being explorer, we wanted to get an inside story. And we looked at the incredible work of those park rangers, the Virunga Alliance, headed by Emmanuel Demarode. We looked at their work and how on a daily basis they sort of face bullets. In fact, not sort of face bullets, actually face bullets. Emmanuel, the head of the park, having been shot a number of times last year. In fact, just quickly on that, the statistics related to how brave these guys are and how tragic the situation they're in is, I think since 1996, 152 brave park rangers have died in the line of duty. And that's because they believe and feel that it's worth taking the risk, to risk their lives to protect these incredible creatures and the landscape. So we've focused on that, and I think the viewers will really enjoy the journey. It's harsh at times, but I think the heroics and the qualities that shine through of the people involved are the most beautiful takeaway, and it's the best of what we can be as humans, in my mind. Then on the other side, we thought that it was really, really important to look at the ground reality of the people that are there. And of course, these people are born of a complex and really, really brutal history. They have pretty much nothing to rely on but nature. And there are 4 million or so people living just a day's walk away from the park. And it's really it was interesting for me to sort of, from afar, you can think, okay, let's protect this beautiful space, Africa's oldest park. the gorillas. But from a ground perspective, if you've got nothing but nature to rely on, then conservation is the luxury of people with choices, and the people there really don't have any. So we wanted to find out what was going on the ground. And one of the major influences, one of the major pressures on the park are, there are about 5,000 to 8,000 armed militia banded together in various different groups, broadly called Mai Mai, and they vie for control of the natural resources. They live in and outside of the park and control many of the industries that make money locally. And those industries, surprisingly enough, are as simple as charcoal. If you say charcoal, you wouldn't imagine it to be such a major point in conserving the forest. But
right.
Of course it is. Yeah. And the reason is very simple. Hardwoods convert to charcoal. The charcoal fuels the fires that cooks the food that feeds the people. In the absence of options, they have to use these things. And that trade is worth $30 million locally. So one of the things that the Virunga Alliance is doing, and one of the things that we focused on within the film, was creating alternatives and looking for ways to supply alternatives to cook your food, for instance, in lots of different ways, in a very holistic approach to perhaps trying to create infrastructure and heal the damage of the past so that there can be some lasting stability for this area. So complex but telling, and I think that people will come away with certainly a feeling of there is some incredible work underway. The future is certainly not set in stone, and the fragile steps that are being taken could be undone so easily, because historically, if history repeats itself, then all of the work that the Virunga Alliance and Emmanuel are doing and other groups could be undone. But nevertheless, there's some incredible work underway now.
Right, right. A lot of opposing dynamics there. I read that most of the poor residents there live off less than $1.25 a day. And we're talking about millions and millions and millions being produced from this park. The park itself being one of the richest areas in the world. And then, of course, I also read it's one of the bloodiest areas because of all the militia there. So there's so much going on there. You said earlier to me that seeing the people and working with the people, the park rangers in particular, of course, who are saving, you know, the silverback gorillas and the environment. You said that they are the best of what we can be as humans, as human beings. I'm wondering what you personally took away from that.
It's very strange, actually, because most people imagining going to meet the silverback gorilla, a silverback gorilla in the middle of the forest in such an incredible area, would imagine that to be the absolute highlight. But as I trekked through the forest with Inasom Mwembe, the commander of the southern sector, a man in charge of protecting pretty much half the world's remaining mountain gorillas, it was when we encountered the gorillas that I saw him, and I looked at him in the eyes and I asked him, I said, you know, is this why you do it? And he turned to me and he didn't really have to say anything at all. It was just such a powerful moment. And I realized that there was such a beautiful strength, such a determination. And this man is risking his life on a daily basis.
Right.
Protect these animals. So that was the biggest thing for me, just the power and commitment and conviction that we're capable of.
And so with this explorer story, Battle for Virunga, what do you hope people will take away from it, and what do you hope will change, if anything, coming from this?
I would really hope that you know, knowledge being the first step to inquisitive natures, you know, knowledge being the first step to learning more,
sure,
to asking more questions, I hope that this film, when people sitting back at home enter this world, are immersed in this world through the show, I hope that they get inspired. And ultimately, it would be wonderful if we could direct some attention towards the people actively on the ground trying to make a difference, because their aims are incredibly ambitious but extraordinarily against the odds. So they need all the help that they can get. So for my part, I'm very proud to have been involved in a project that seeks to sort of focus on their work too.
Right. And so I have to let you go in a minute. I know that. But I'd like to just get what was you talked about the highlights being the, you know, really meeting the head park ranger and his passion for what he was doing. But what was a really challenging moment for you there?
One of the, I mean, as people see in the show, there's a particularly tricky encounter with the Mai Mai warriors in their encampment late at night. We arrive just as the sun's going down. Not advisable under any circumstances. These kids are, I say kids because basically from pretty much 11 to 21-year-old young men armed with AK-47s, prone to drinking ethyl alcohol, smoking large amounts of ganja, sitting by a fire, were my gateway guardians to meeting the commander. And I sat in a hut, not being able to communicate, obviously, with these characters. They were getting progressively drunk, and teenagers being teenagers, they're vying for control, expressing their prowess and bashing their guns on the ground and leering forward. And it was, the turning point was the most remarkable thing, as is with most of the world and most tribal scenarios, in fact, nowadays. They have mobile phones. And so this young character's phone started to play a reggae tune, and I actually recognized it. So I'm in the middle of the jungle on the border of Virunga National Park in North Kivu region with in an encampment with five heavily armed, drunken young warrior kids, and this reggae tune starts playing. And because I recognized it, I started to move in sort of to dance in a ridiculous manner, make a joke of it. I'm not dancing, but just sort of gyrating around. And it broke them into hysterics. And from that moment, it was a record by Peter Tosh that I remembered. And instantly, one of them said, I'll look after you for 2 weeks from now on.
Oh, wow. Well, that was good.
Music was the communication that saved me.
Yes.
I saved me. Perhaps that's a bit extreme, but it broke the ice, and it was a wonderful thing. So technology, again, in such a remote location, played a communication, a very valid role.
Right. Well, Justin Hall, I thank you so much for being with us. The show, of course, is called Explorer Battle for Virunga. And thanks for being with us today. Appreciate your time.
Oh, more than welcome. It's lovely to talk to you. It airs on National Geographic Channel on
June 26th. Yep, June 26th at 8, 7 Central on National Geographic.
Excellent. I hope people enjoy it. Thank you.
And that was Explorer correspondent Justin Hall talking about the great new series that is on National Geographic Channel. And this particular episode is called Explorer Battle for Virunga. It does air, as we said, Sunday, June 26th at 8, 7 Central on National Geographic Channel. And if you like to read, you can pick up also a July issue of National Geographic Magazine. I know many of you do like to read National Geographic magazine. And so in addition to the Explorer episode, there's an article in the July issue written by Robert Draper and photographed by Brent Sturton. And also, if you go to the website, you can see some clips, some advanced clips up there, nationalgeographic.com. If you just type in National Geographic Explorer Battle for Virunga, it will come straight up. And I want to give a shout out because, you know, there's so many dynamics, as you heard Justin talk about, so many opposing dynamics going on in that environment, which is so rich in many, many ways and so poor in other ways. And, you know, exploitation really does threaten to destroy the Africa's oldest national park. But I think those park, the park director, Emmanuel de Marot, I may butcher this name, and veteran park ranger Innocent, I really can't say his name, Baranwi, but Justin mentioned both of those in the interview. They were both recipients of the 2015 Rolex National Geographic Explorer of the Year Award. So they are doing really, really great work out there. And again, you can catch the TV show Sunday, June 26th at 8, 7 Central on National Geographic Channel. All right, please stay with us. We're going to take a break, and we're going to play out with some of the reggae music that saved Justin Hall in his hour of need. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
I didn't talk for a long time. I was sensitive to lights and sounds, so I'd build secret hiding places where they couldn't get in. Sometimes I'd do the same things over and over, until one day I found out I had autism. My family got me help. Slowly, I learned how to live with it better.
Early intervention can make a lifetime of difference. Learn the signs at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicky St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicky partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicky today. Email Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicky and her work at VickySt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Easy on the ears, good for the soul. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And we're hearing next from Sebastian Junger. I actually spoke with him about 2 weeks ago. We're bringing you this interview for the first time. Why do we pre-tape? Well, sometimes because of the guest schedule conflict. Sometimes, they're traveling while we're live on air. So we want to bring you the best guests we can and topics we can. And so that's why we sometimes tape. So Sebastian Junger, I'm sure his name is familiar with you, if from nothing else, from The Perfect Storm, which got made into a movie with George Clooney and Diane Lane and some other excellent actors. But his work expands far beyond that. He's the number one New York Times bestselling author of War, The Perfect Storm, Fire, and A Death in Belmont. And together with Tim Hetherington, he directed the documentary Restrepo, which won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance. He's a contributing editor also to Vanity Fair and has been awarded a National Magazine Award and an SAIS Novartis Prize for Journalism. His new book is called Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging, and it basically explores what we can learn from tribal societies about loyalty, belonging, and the eternal human quest for meaning. As I said at the top of the hour, it's a publisher's weekly most anticipated book of 2016. It's also an Entertainment Weekly top book, top 25 book in 2016. And small book that it is, it certainly made me stop and think about a lot of things very differently. Here's my conversation with Sebastian Junger, his book Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging. You say we have a strong instinct to belong to small groups that have defined and a very clear purpose, and you call these tribes. And the book actually spun off from an article you wrote for Vanity Fair. So tell us how that article came about and then led to the book.
Well, I was sort of pondering the high rates of PTSD in American soldiers, and it occurred to me that maybe the problem wasn't the trauma on the battlefield, which compared to previous wars is relatively low in these two wars, meaning far fewer casualties, thank God, than previous wars. But the rates of PTSD are higher, and I thought maybe what determines long-term PTSD is actually the kind of society you return to. And having been an anthropologist in college, I did my field work on the Navajo Reservation. I thought maybe the Navajo and the Apache and the Comanche, you know, the tribal peoples, actually, the warriors actually didn't suffer from PTSD because they came back from combat straight into a close, cohesive society. And then it occurred to me that soldiers in combat are in a platoon of 30, 40, 50 people doing everything together, sleeping together, eating together, doing tasks and missions together. That's exactly a recreation of our evolutionary past. And it must feel very good to be that interconnected with a small group of people. We're wired for that. We definitely respond well to it. So maybe what's actually going on is that 10% of soldiers are actually in combat, and maybe they're traumatized, but the other 90% of the military really isn't traumatized much at all. But an enormous number of them come back and feel like they don't belong at home. And maybe what's happening is they're just having trouble reassimilating into a society that really doesn't have a communal center of gravity in the first place.
Right. And what kind of reaction did you get from readers about the Vanity Fair article? I'm assuming it was very overwhelming because it ultimately led to a book.
Yeah, the reaction I got from veterans was amazing. I mean, basically, many, many veterans said some version of, oh my God, that's it. That's the thing we've all been feeling, but didn't quite know how to say.
Right.
It's the society, and it's not that they're not welcomed enough. People are enormously appreciative of soldiers, even people who are against the wars. It's not that they're not welcomed. It's not that they're not honored and understood. It's that there's sort of no there. Like, when you come back to the society, Peace Corps volunteers have a similar problem. People getting out of prison have a similar problem. You come back to the society, and you can't figure out what exactly there is to belong to. It's not cohesive. It's not community-oriented. There's no common purpose, common goal, which, of course, defines life in combat, life in the military.
Yeah, and journalists, too, because you share your own story in the book about you coming back after reporting from wars. And I remember when I talked with Dan Harris last year, he wrote a book about his experience coming back after reporting for ABC. On the war, and how he just went into this major depression when he came back to New York and could not settle back in there, even though he'd been there for years. Tell us what your experience was like when you came back.
Well, you know, I started covering wars in the early 90s. It took me a long time to be in any kind of combat involving American soldiers. Probably the most severe case of trauma that I had was in the fall of 2000, so a year before 9/11. I was with the forces of Ahmad Shah Massoud in Badakhshan in northern Afghanistan, fighting the Taliban. Back when the Taliban had an air force, had fighter planes, had tanks, and you know, we got spanked pretty hard a couple of times tough stuff happened to us in that fight. And I came home, and I never even heard of PTSD, but I came home to New York, and you know, I didn't think it had affected me at all. But one day I tried to take the subway, and it was rush hour, and I had a complete panic attack on the subway platform. I'd never had a panic attack before, and I literally couldn't stay down there. I thought everything was trying to kill me, the trains, the people, the lights were too bright. I mean, everything was a threat to my life, and I sprinted out of there. And that went on for some months. And I later realized it was PTSD. At the time, I just thought I was going crazy, and I'd tell him.
Right, right. And I think that, as you say, this is something many, many people can relate to. They don't have to have seen actual combat to go through this. You write in the book, and some will find this provocative and or counterintuitive, but your main premise is that war and catastrophe seem to instill the tribal spirit that we have lost as individuals. And here, I think, is where we might think it's counterintuitive, but the stress of such events can actually improve mental health rather than threaten it. And, you know, if listeners are raising their eyebrows at that, then you have plenty of academic and anecdotal support around that theory. So talk to us about that, if you would.
Yeah, and you know, I just want to say I'm a journalist, and you know, the one thing journalists don't do or shouldn't do is offer opinions. There's not one opinion in the book, but there's an awful lot of data and statistics and studies and facts. And so what the great sociologist Emil Durkheim found was that countries at war in the 1800s, European countries at war, saw a remarkable drop in their suicide rate. In New York after 9/11, totally traumatized city. But what happened in the 6 months following, the suicide rate went down, murder rate went down, violent crime went down. Even Vietnam vets with PTSD said that their symptoms improved after 9/11. The Blitz in London, 30,000 Londoners were killed. Terrible time, people sleeping shoulder to shoulder on the subway platforms. But the authorities anticipated mass psychiatric casualties, people just freaking out and having panic attacks and checking themselves into psychiatric wards or being delivered forcibly to psychiatric wards. But the opposite happened. When the bombing started, admissions to psychiatric wards went down.
Mm-hmm.
And then went back up when the bombing stopped. So what we take from this isn't that people like war, of course, or earthquakes or anything else. It's that when humans are faced with adversity, they band together. And that banding together in a modern society that doesn't often get to enjoy that banding together leads to an incredible sort of reinforcing of mental health in people and really allows people to serve the common good rather than to just worry about themselves, as one official in London said, we have neurotics driving ambulances.
Right, right. I'm wondering how much of that is having a common enemy, if you will, because I'm thinking as you're talking back to my grandparents who went through two world wars, and they talked incessantly about, you know, the bonding that was there, and everybody was looking out for them, for each other. Nobody was out there just for themselves because they had a common enemy in mind, and they were going through great hardships. Did you look into that aspect of it?
I think having an enemy is often the source of catastrophe in human history, but not exclusively. I found there was an earthquake in Avezzano, Italy, in the early 1900s, and one survivor noted that after the earthquake, something like 90% of the population was killed, or something like that. It was a devastating earthquake. Mm-hmm. Survivors were, you know, they were on their own for days before help could get there, and one survivor said that, you know, class distinction disappeared. There was no rich, there was no poor, there was just people helping each other. And it was this almost a sort of utopian, egalitarian society for a little while, despite all the terror and the hardships and everything else. And this person said that the earthquake gave them what the law promises but cannot, in fact, deliver, which is the equality of all men. That's one of the things that people, I don't want to say like, but that people respond positively to in situations of crisis.
Yeah, that makes sense. You have a Benjamin Franklin quote in the book, which I found interesting. He's talking about how many settlers ran away to Indian tribes, even if after they were captured and released, some would run back to the Indian tribe. But it never happened the other way. The Indians never wanted to come and join us.
Yeah, I mean, a number of writers and thinkers at the time commented on this because it was an issue of some puzzlement and even consternation. I mean, here's this supposedly superior, civilized Christian society, and just to, you know, go into the woods a little ways, and then you come to the heathen, what they called the heathens, savages. And as several people at the time commented, that settlers along the frontier were constantly running off to join the Indian tribes. And the Indians never did the same thing. They never ran out to join civilization. And we, in fact, in our language, we have, you know, the phrase to go native. And there's no equivalent phrase, you know, to go civilized, just because no one really wants to do that.
Right. And I want to just point out why we're using the term Indian, because when you were doing some research, you talked with somebody who had a very strong opinion on that. Share that with our listeners, yeah. Would you? Because we're also PC these days, but I think it's important to share that.
No, I was being very carefully PC in speaking with a wonderful man named Gregory Gomez, who is a member of the Apache Nation and in the southwest of the United States. And he's a Vietnam vet. And I used the term Native American, and he said, well, that actually technically really means anyone who's born in North America. He said, but I am an American Indian, and I appreciate if you use the term Indian. So I was like, okay, we'll do that then.
Right, right. So my guest is Sebastian Younger. His new book is called Tribe on Homecoming and Belonging. And talking of belonging, the issue really, as you see it then, is that the profound alienation that we feel at large, and technology is not helping in this way at all. But you say it's led to, in America, to income inequality, destructive behaviors to each other, to the environment, the high rates of suicide we touched on, mental illness, including PTSD, and even rampage shootings. How did you put all of this together? Let's talk about the rampage shootings, because this is a major issue in our country.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily say that there's a cause and effect. I mean, I don't know. I don't think anyone could determine that. But it is interesting to note that in a country awash in guns, the communities where rampage shootings tend to happen are middle-class, upper-middle-class white communities. There's never been a rampage shooting in a high-crime urban neighborhood, for example. And it struck me that these are the communities, so middle class, upper middle class white communities, or rural towns, or white Christian towns with very low crime rates. These are places that don't have a lot of communal connection, and it may be that starting in the 1980s, when rampage shootings suddenly reappeared in America. There was a spate of them in the 30s after the Great Depression put society under enormous social strain. They went away, and there were no rampage shootings during the Second World War, for example, in accordance with Durkheim's theories about war. And then in the 1980s, during the Reagan administration, they started. And they got worse and worse, and suddenly in 2006, they got really bad. And I just say in the book, there may be most of the people who commit these shootings are white males from middle-class communities, and they often happen in those kinds of communities, and I just offer the possibility. It may be that kind of middle-class American society does not offer the kind of social support and intimacy that might prevent otherwise deranged, violent young men from turning their anger outwards on innocent people.
Right. And you certainly, I mean, this was one of the most thought-provoking books I've read in quite a while. I'm sure you're hearing that a lot from people you're talking with, because it does make you stop and think. And I've...
Thank you.
Well, that's what it's all about, right? But
it is what it's all about, yeah.
I've done a ton of research over a two-year period. I did a ton of research on cults and gangs and certain religious sects where there's a very strong tribal influence of a different kind. In fact, when I was researching certain gangs, some of the prospects who were trying to enter a biker's club, they were being tested out for gang worthiness or club worthiness, if you will, were ex-military who expressed exactly what you're talking about in the book, this intrinsic needing to belong. And when they come back from the war, you know, even if they weren't in combat, they're looking for that brotherhood still. So it made perfect sense
to
me.
I mean, the Hells and Angels were started by World War II vets.
Yeah.
We're primates. We're a social species, like all primates, or most primates. We're a social species, and we're joiners. And if society doesn't offer young people, offer people in general, good things to join, they'll create bad things to join, but join they will. I mean, they will create something to join. And in a traditional tribal society, you're existing in a community that is already joined. I mean, your community is the motorcycle gang, as it were. In modern society, that's not, obviously, it's a different system, but I'm obviously a man, and as a young man, I remember desperately wanting to belong to something, and belong to something that was sort of dangerous, you know, and where I could sort of prove myself, and there was just nothing. I grew up in a suburb. There was just nothing.
Yeah.
There was certainly nothing legal, and there wasn't even much illegal.
Yes. One of my favorite mythologists, Joseph Campbell, wrote extensively about that and why young men join gangs. He talked extensively too about the importance of tribal rituals and rites of passage, and you touch on that in the book, because we really don't have those today. I think it's more certain families who have it rather than society at large.
Yeah, and Campbell's one of my favorites too. He's amazing. We live in a very de-ritualized society.
Yeah.
And that affects young women and young men in different ways, because traditionally young men and young women undergo different rituals because they have different uses in society.
You share a story in the book talking about male and female there. You share a story in the book, I wonder if you'd share with our listeners, about how certain women are helped along all through their life. People will come to their rescue, but men have to wait a certain age for that same kind of rescue.
Yeah, well, it's a phenomenon called bystander rescue, and these are people who are, you know, basically walking down the street, and they see someone else in danger, someone they're not related to, someone they don't know, but it's another human being in danger. You know, who goes to the rescue of that person? Often these rescues are very dangerous, and something like 20% of the incidents that were researched in this one study wound up in the death of the rescuer. So they're very dangerous things too. And almost without exception, 95, 96, 98, I can't remember exactly, enormous percentage of the time, it was men who did these rescues. And there were women around, but what the women seemed to do is if there were men present, the women let the men do it. If there were no men around, a woman would step up and do it. But they sort of let the men go first. And what the statistics show was that children are always rescued. Old people are always rescued. Women of childbearing age are always rescued. But men, once they hit puberty, the likelihood of them being rescued by another person they don't know who's going to risk their life to help them goes way, way down. And they have to wait until they're 75 years old until they get the level of rescue that women enjoy their entire lives, regardless of their age.
Isn't that interesting? And I think it proves a point, a big point. we're almost at the end of our segment, and I want to just ask you what this means to you, because you share a story at the beginning of the book and one at the end of the book that actually relate and brought this story full circle for you. So tell us what just dead inside means to you.
Well, thank you for asking that, because this is a story I'm very fond of. When I was a young man out of college, I hitchhiked across the United States. And at one point, I was stopped outside Gillette, Wyoming, which is a pretty tough coal mining town, and I was getting beer bottles thrown at me, and it was pretty miserable. And this guy walked out from town to check on me, and he said he was homeless. He lived in a car. He would walk out to the coal mine every day to see if they needed workers, and usually they didn't. And he said, today they don't. And I just saw you on the highway here, and I was worried about you. I just thought I'd come out here and check on you, make sure you're okay. And I want to give you my lunch. So I told him I was going to California, and all I had was a little cheese. And he said, you can't get to California a little cheese, and I won't be needing my lunch because they don't need me at the coal mine today. And he made me take his lunch. I felt terrible about it. And then he walked back to his car that he was living in. And I thought, well, there's someone who, generosity is one thing. Lots of people are generous. But he saw me on the highway half a mile away and walked out there to check on me because he was taking responsibility for me. And he was taking responsibility for someone who I think he saw as part of his same tribe. I looked homeless to him. I was out on the highway, and he was homeless. We were in the same tribe. And so then at the end of my book, I talk about this incident where an anthropologist is with the Cree Indians in Canada, and she goes out into the woods on a long hunting trip with this one guy. And they run across a couple of other guys who are out there hunting and trapping, and those guys have run completely out of food. And the Cree Indian that this anthropologist is with gives these two strangers most of his food, and which means he'll have to cut his own trip short. He'll make less money. He'll catch less fewer first. And this woman, the anthropologist, asked him about it, and he said, look, if you don't give them food, you're just dead inside. You don't give someone who's hungry, give them food, you're dead inside. And finally I had my answer to why that guy outside Gillette, Wyoming, had gave me his lunch. He did not want to be dead inside. He had no control over many circumstances of his life, but he did have control of that and refused to be dead inside. It's just an incredibly moving thing to me.
Yeah, I love that story. Thank you for sharing that with us. Sebastian Younger, great talking with you. And that was Sebastian Younger. His book is called Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. And this is not a book about soldiers. It's about all of us. It's about finding our tribe. And I really did love that story that he shared at the end, because I think it epitomized really what he was talking about. And you can find out more about Sebastian and his work at sebastianyounger.com, sebastianyounger.com. And I just want to also remind you about my first guest, the acclaimed series from National Geographic that's coming up this Sunday, June 26th at 8, 7 Central on National Geographic Channel. It's Explorers Battle for Virunga. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Thank you for joining us. I think lots to discuss there, really, with both of those guests. I would have loved to have talked with them for much longer, but, we have time limits on these things. So you can find out more about us at conversationslive.net or at vickysaintclair.com. You can find us on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair. And if you have questions on today's show or comments or feedback, would like any of the information that we shared today or guest information, you can reach me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617, or you can email me at info@conversationslive.net. All right, that's it for this week. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you.
call 425-269-4772.